Self-aware millennial. Welcome back to the Self-Aware Millennial. I am your host, J Mix, and this episode is brought to you by the letters A, C, C, O, U, N, T, A, B, I, L, I, T, Y. Accountability. And I'm going to tell you why. This week has been an overflow of success stories in the cause and effect of holding people accountable. And I'm going to leave it at that for now because I did promise y'all that I was going to give you more information on the organizations that have been powering this city and fueling the fire to allow me and other advocates to have enough energy and drive to give you the information that we need y'all to have in order to combat and show solidarity for Black lives. The first organization I want to give a shout out to, because I think this one of all of them is going to be easy for everyone to access. And honestly, they show solidarity to all of the organizations that are basically all fighting for the same thing: human rights and for Black lives. I mean, like, once Black lives matter, all lives matter, but we already know that. The Southern Solidarity political organization, they deliver food and medical supplies to over like 300 unhoused people like every single day. And they organize with the unhoused around to fight for permanent housing. But while they're not doing that, they are also showing solidarity for the Black Lives Matter movement and like the hospitality workers, which I'll go into in a second, the New Orleans Workers Group and everybody. Like, they have been giving information to the public for all these organizations as to like how you can help, how you can show up to their rallies. Like, they're like the hub to everything Black Lives Matter movement in New Orleans. If you are looking to want to support, they have all the information right there on their pages. It's been very, very resourceful. So if you didn't get that name, that was Southern Solidarity. Another organization I have been following closely is the Orleans Parish Prison Reform Coalition. They are a group of concerned organizations and individuals from diverse political, economic, and cultural backgrounds. They're representing a broad sector of the New Orleans community who have come together to advocate for a smaller jail and the relocation of funds for incarceration and detention to building the infrastructure of a caring community. But their main focus is to defund prisons, because clearly, if you've watched 13th on Netflix, that is a high recommendation. You know that prisons were definitely populated to make up for what slavery used to do legally. Anywho, the next one I want to highlight is the New Orleans Hospitality Workers. This organization is a space for workers all over the city to speak their issues and realize the consequences of their unfair treatment they are receiving. They are uniting to create a workers' bill of rights to bring to New Orleans lawmakers to propose law creation and reformation, and use our numbers to support and advocate for workers laboring in unjust conditions. I recently shared on my personal Instagram some grievances I had with the previous employer that I was part of, but also I've created a form for current and past employees and patrons to express their grievances about what they have experienced at this restaurant as well. And I believe I already said the name of the restaurant. So it's Willa Jean. And if you would like, I would love if you have any stories or experiences that you need to get out. I mean, every experience is important and somebody has to hold them accountable. If they claim to be a diverse, inclusive space, you have to make way for the uncomfortable conversations and the uncomfortable acts that have already transpired within that space. So if you're interested, check out my link tree on my bio and Instagram, and there is a link to the Hold Willa Jean Accountable survey. I would love your thoughts, and this is all going to be presented to them very soon. So please do it soon so I can get it to them very soon. The final organization, and my most favorite organization that has been killing the game in New Orleans, is the New Orleans Workers Group. They are a socialist organization of revolutionary workers fighting back against oppression and exploitation in New Orleans. They have organized all the peaceful protests and marches that have made the news the tear gassing and everything, like that was all New Orleans workers group. We also had the other groups like hospitality workers, the OPPRC, all of them were also within that group, but the Orleans Parish, I'm sorry, the workers group were the ones that organized all of it. The organizers that they have are exactly that. They are organized. They make sure that the entire crowd is aware of what they are about to do. They give them the option of leaving if they are not for it and everything. Like, they are very meticulous and they know exactly what they are doing before they talk to the masses. And it is amazing to watch and to witness. They always have a concrete plan of action, and I just admire them for their bravery and their solidarity and their passion. And I really believe it was because of this organization that we have gotten the ground that we have gotten so far. Though we are definitely not anywhere close to where we want to be, but they are fueling the fire in this entire city in order to make that happen. So again, that is the New Orleans Workers Group. Please follow them. Please check out their rallies. Their rallies also, I will say, that's where you learn most of the information. That's where you are educated. And then if you want to, you don't even have to go march if you don't want to. Usually they'll do a march right after. But I'm telling you, if you want to just go to the Orleans Workers Group rallies and get information and get educated, that is the place to go of all the places that I have witnessed thus far. I'm highly recommended. And again, I will link these organizations in the description so that y'all can check them out for yourselves. But again, I can do this for you, but you have to do the work yourself as well. Like, I can give you these resources. I can give you my recommendations. I can give you my input, my insight, my exhaustion and everything. But it's not going to mean a damn thing unless you're actually going out there and trying to educate yourself and understand where maybe me and other folks of color and Black people are coming from. Okay, y'all, I'm going into a tangent. Let me keep going. I had a conversation with my parents recently. I wouldn't consider it a complete conversation, but it was definitely a realization that I had talking to them. I said that, you know, young Black millennials and people that are younger than, you know, their generations, they have the resources to destigmatize the systemic downfalls of the elders' generations. Case in point, what I'm basically saying is that we have more resources than they did. Because of the access to information that we all have now, we can use that knowledge that we now have that was once with our elders hidden from us to elevate our intelligence. We are now attaining that intelligence and being able to use it as receipts and as fire to what we wish we could have communicated in the time of my parents and my grandparents and their generations, even before that. We're having difficulty getting them to realize that their ideals about the life that they have lived this entire time have been based off of systemic constructs that were out of their control. So it's just very difficult, I guess, if you want to put it in plain terms, to teach an old dog new tricks. But I personally believe it's possible, but you have to have that compassion. You have to get to the patience of understanding where they're falling short and where they still have room to grow, even as a 65-year-old man and woman. You know, like, it's possible to still turn your thinking and your perspective on life around, even at that high of an age. It is possible. It's just tiring and exhausting. But I believe in us Black millennials and just Black everybody who has that wokeness and that self-awareness about themselves to try to elevate that information to your elders, because they are still looking to you. They know that you are going to be carrying their legacy. They know that you are going to be making this world a better place than they have lived in. And they know that. So they need to know what you are trying to do to accomplish that. And if they are aware of that, they're going to support you. They are going to follow you. It may take them a bit, but I have every certainty that they will follow suit and support you. Before we bring our guest on, I wanted to bring up one more important bit of information that I think is going to be a little reassuring for a lot of people, but also it's another teaching moment as to what I have not just dealt with within the last week, but what I've been learning about myself throughout this entire time, having to fight for Black lives, but also still being quarantined. When it comes to talking about Black lives, when it comes to talking about anything that is emotionally charged, it is very, very important that you try to have those conversations in person. If you can't have them in person because of COVID, at least FaceTime them, or at least have some sort of way of having facial expressions in the mix, because it is easy to get things misconstrued through text. If that's the case, it happens all the time online. Most people that are talking to each other actually are agreeing about everything that they are saying to each other, but because they are missing context about that by not seeing each other in the way that they are processing the information, it's very difficult not to choose a side, and it's very difficult to see that person as a human that is capable of not always being right all the time. I had a follow-up conversation with the guy that I mentioned last week about the conversation that we had, and that's exactly what happened. We actually had an in-person conversation and we were able to hash everything out. It turns out that we both were fighting for the exact same thing in a way. We just had different ways of going about it. The misconstrued notions that I felt were being exhibited in the conversation that we initially had were mostly biases that I had accrued from not being in contact with this person for a long time and having other thoughts get the best of me. And the issue is like, I already knew this person was for the cause like this entire time, but something inside me was not being trustful towards him. And I maybe went a little overboard and distrusted him. And I mean, rightfully so, but also not rightfully so. And the same thing happened on his end with me. And we addressed all that. And I guess the main thing I want to take from this for you guys is that it is important to have these conversations in person, because it is not worth losing friendships, good friendships, in order to keep your pride and your privilege or whatever you decide to have. It's not worth keeping those things and not having the human interaction to back it up. That was easily a conversation, a friendship that would have never rekindled had, and honestly, I remember I was like, I'm not gonna say anything because I don't think I deserve to, you know, like, but the funny thing was like when he contacted me, he was like, you know, he already wanted to have the conversation and, you know, it was bothering him as well. So it's like, you just never know what another person is going through. And there were plenty of other elements going on through that that motivated the responses that we gave each other. But the fact of the matter is that we were able to rekindle a friendship and now it's stronger than ever. So I encourage all of you to do the same if you are feeling as though you have a ally of yours that you just feel like there's a miscommunication, that it really isn't much about the bigger picture. Make sure that you're getting that interpersonal conversation and connection. Make sure that that is set in stone before you go into the macro of trying to figure out racial biases and racial prejudices, which are just as important. But you have to make sure that the connection that you have with others is there in order to have those bigger conversations. Because it's a trust factor. You have to trust people before you can even talk about the other things that are important. And I know for everybody that's different. Everyone is different when it comes to that. But I know for me, I normally like to trust the people that I'm talking to before I go any further. And the way I do that is through having just conversations about who we are as people, if that makes sense. Well, you guys, I'm so excited for y'all to meet these two lovely people that you're about to hear from. We have John Sparks and Maritza Davila. John and Maritza have been in a successful interracial marriage for over 40 years at this point. As a journalist, John Sparks has interviewed murderers, futurists, school teachers, politicians, and celebrities from Yo-Yo Ma Walter. As an actor, he appeared as Benjamin Franklin in Sleepy Hollow. and as a crazed assassin in Nothing But the Truth with Vera Farmiga. He is also Santa Claus on the Polar Express train ride and is widely considered to be the real Santa Claus. And if you are watching this on YouTube, you will know exactly why. Maritza Davila was born in Puerto Rico and received her Master of Fine Arts from Pratt Institute. She is Professor Emeritus at the former Memphis College of Art, where she taught printmaking and foundations for 36 years. She's now teaching printmaking at the University of Memphis. She also owns Atabera Press, and her artworks have been exhibited in museums and galleries worldwide since the 1970s. This conversation was near and dear to my heart, and I hope that you guys enjoy my conversation with John and Maritza. In anticipation and preparation for this episode, I reached out to a lot of my other friends who have also been involved in interracial relationships themselves to kind of get guidance from you guys, if you wanted to, you know, offer up that wisdom, that insight for them and myself, because, I mean, I'm also in an interracial relationship. But, you know, just for everybody, because I think that it's important to not, like they say, repeat history. And if we can try our best to not do that by listening to our elders, like, it's going to impact the way our future children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, or however, you know, how they maneuver through the world. So if y'all are okay with that, then we could totally continue.
Very ancient.
Oh, you're not that ancient. I know I'm like saying it like that, but y'all are definitely
and the elders and the side of it, and I just feel like, oh my God.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that.
I was really okay with it the first time I got my social security check. And I said, oh, well, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
Just put me anything you want.
I've been very thankful for the community that I have accrued through this podcast thus far. So I'm really thankful that you guys are now going to be a part of that community. And yeah, thank you.
And I just say thank you for doing it, because first of all, just the technical effort of putting together a podcast and rounding up people and equipment and timing and scheduling and all of that is huge. And you have undertaken it. And I know you've talked about how you're also then going to Black Lives Matter protests and all that. So your life is very full, right?
Yes.
I very much appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's full, but it's worth it. It's so much worth it than the life I had before COVID. So, like, you know, it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like it was meant to be. Or like I've been preparing my hard work that I've had throughout all the years for this type of work to like dedicate to it, because I've already developed the skills of working hard before COVID so that I can dedicate that same energy to doing the work that I choose to do, if that makes sense.
Anyway. Isn't it amazing how circumstances bring blessings in disguise?
Yeah.
How we are forced to stop, and even though that the circumstances are not the best ones, if we choose to, we can be our best under those circumstances.
Yes.
And it calls us to do things that we did not think about, you know, on the other circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, we are called to do this, which is an affirmament of togetherness. There is unity, there is love, there is hope.
There was an interesting article I read recently, or maybe I heard it from someone, it might have been on your podcast, but the idea really interested me, because it was the whole thing with the virus and the quarantine and having changed people's social and work lives, has in a certain way united us. At least there's a commonality of our situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that had not happened, and yet we had what happened in Minnesota happened, and then the protests started.
Yeah.
And I figured, well, the protests will last a couple of days and they'll be local.
Yeah.
It shows you how wrong somebody can be.
Yeah.
And it kept going and going. And I think that the fact that the country is all bound up in this quarantine contributed to the fact that the country looked at what went on there. This is enough.
Yep.
Enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They didn't have the distractions of like the regular normal life of, you know, having to get back to work and like everything else that is actually important to them, like being put to the side. Like it happens because of the society we live in. It's very, you know, go, 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 very hardworking, very, you know, it's very easy to forget like your personal morals and what you want out of your life because you're trying to make someone else's life better or more richer or whatever. So capitalist society, there you go.
Just mentioned with John this morning how everything that is happening is reflecting in my work.
Yeah.
In a way that is very meaningful to me in so many aspects.
Yeah.
And in a way, I just, in a way, and in a clarity that maybe under other circumstances, it would not have happened this way.
Yeah.
I just feel this urgency to put it out there. What I'm doing and what I have done, which it was coming for a while now, I'm very happy to say that is relevant to the times. And I feel that I'm saying something that is needed at this time.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a privilege and an honor to be able to be in that position.
Yeah.
And not in any bit arrogant about it, but humble about me having the opportunity and to take the commitment of doing so. And that really, it's just like, oh my gosh, this.
If I could also just mention that, you know, her work is so much about her heritage, about who she is, her ancestors, in Puerto Rico, where she grew up, about the culture there. So culture, genealogy, all of that is crucial.
And being biracial, being comfortable finally after being a struggling growing up, you know, when you don't know who you are or where do you fit.
Yeah.
Choose for me, how am I going to fit? No one telling me who I am, but me telling them, this is who I am. And all of these parts make this person I am. And all of those parts needs to be celebrated.
Absolutely. Come on now.
My work for a while of celebration, a celebration of my African, European, and indigenous roots.
Yeah. I love it.
And how it relates to language and how it relates to my experience growing up and how it relates to what I look like, because I'm using myself, I'm using my own body.
Yeah.
As part of reflecting those things.
Yeah. Needing to show and represent yourself as yourself and for everyone else that sees you to see you exactly as you are. I feel that. That's me. I understand.
Yeah. And so by doing so, like you just said, I'm not alone. There's so many other people.
Yeah.
With so many similar experiences.
Yes.
Or either just one race or the other. Mm-hmm. It applies because it's about the humanity.
Yes.
That we share.
Yes. That's exactly what they try to preach at the protests right now. You know, like, you can't say that you're for Black lives and then you're not for trans lives. Black trans lives are in that number. It's like you can't just pick and choose which Black lives you are fighting for. And like they say, like, you know, all lives won't matter until Black lives matter. It's the truth, because there is a form of humanity. Like, they're basically trying to say, see my humanity so that we can all exist in humanity and understand each other together. Until then, like, you're not seeing my humanity. You're seeing you're not seeing my humanity. You think I'm inferior. So, yeah.
And I'm telling you, the conversation is going to many, many places. Some of them, they're beautiful places. Some of them are very ugly places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have people commenting about the other, like, that's not my problem.
Yeah.
You know, that is your problem. Or this is a problem of power.
Yeah.
Of getting power back. Or this is a problem of, I mean, so many ugly places. And I always respond, this is all our problem.
Yes.
This is not about the other. This is about us.
Absolutely.
We have two children, grown children.
Mm-hmm.
They both live here. Mm-hmm. And our daughter posted something on Facebook recently.
Mm-hmm.
That it was fascinating for me to read because she and I had not talked about this.
No.
But she, of course, is the daughter of a mixed and a white guy. But she's always thought of herself, well, it's complicated.
Yeah.
How you think of yourself. Sometimes you think of yourself this way, sometimes, depending on your situation, maybe the people that are around you and all that. And she went to school, you know, public schools here in Memphis,
mm-hmm.
which are majority Black. And she just would often run into this kind of situation where she might be with some Black people and she would say, well, I'm Black. I've got that in me. Her grandfather was Black, absolutely. And then they would say, no, you're not. During the winter, she'd be lighter. In the summer, she tans so beautifully, yeah. Looks dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She said, some guy told her, what was it? He said, girl, you so dark, you wouldn't be able to get a cab in New York City.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah. So she has been thinking about this and dealing with it.
Yeah.
And she's lighter than me. People think that she's maybe Iranian. But I wasn't aware that sometimes to the point of being bullied, sometimes at school, you know, telling, well, you feeling like she did not fit.
Yeah, she didn't know where to place herself.
This is when I felt when I came to the States.
Mm-hmm.
People always confronting me at so many levels, confronting me from appearance to knowledge to my own experience.
Yeah.
There to being so ignorant to a point of asking very stupid questions.
What kind of questions you have any that in particular that speak out or stand out in your mind?
Well, yeah, they were talking, and we're talking about the 70s.
Okay.
Mid-70s in New York City. People asking me, one particular person asking me, at least a few asking me, if we have indoor plumbing, if we have TV, if we have roads and stuff like that, if we, it's just, my gosh, you know, they didn't even bother to inform themselves before even asking to know more. She's coming from Puerto Rico. Let me find out about Puerto Rico. Why is it Puerto Rico? You know, they were so proud of their own ignorance.
Yep.
As to say that. And then others will say, well, did you get a scholarship? They say, yes. They say, you see, she got a scholarship because she is Puerto Rican. See?
Yeah.
Or she's here because she is a minority. It was never
just because of your humanity, like you actually just being a person, yes, and like, yes. I feel
it was,
that.
It was never because of me. It was for some other.
Yeah, there had to be an explanation.
Exactly, yeah. Because cannot be possible.
A way for them to validate something to validate their biases, their ignorances.
That's exactly. And so they use it to explain other people how come there were people of color in a place like Pratt Institute.
Which is where?
When I graduated from.
Okay.
You know, I was maybe one of a few colored people,
mm-hmm.
and I was the only Puerto Rican.
Mm.
And it continues. It continues. It continues when the glances that we got walking together with our son. It continues when my son was born, because he looks more like John. That, you know, he's really very light skin, you know, to the in the doctor's office. Whose child is this one?
Yeah.
That was right behind me, says, my baby.
Yeah.
And they would look at me like, they look at him and they look at me like, this cannot be possible.
Must be the nanny.
In my house, people open, me opening the door. My son next to me asking me, where is the lady of the house?
Yeah.
People asking me, do you finish high school?
Oh my gosh. That's terrible. Hold that thought. But I want, just for the listeners, because I mean, obviously, like, I want people to understand how we already have a decent engagement, like where I know you guys from. And, you know, I want them just to be able to like understand like what you already do with your lives and what you have accomplished outside of your racial privileges or oppressions. Like, I want to know, I want people to know like who you are as people. I want to show them your humanity. So I want to just take this quick time to kind of talk about how I know you guys. And then I also want you to describe and talk about like how y'all met each other. And I also want y'all to kind of talk about your backgrounds, like you, each of you, like growing up and then up to you meeting each other and everything. We'll go into all that. But for the listeners, I want y'all to know that I've met, I actually met John first. We did a production of, well, he's actually still doing them, but I've since become a victory bell at the World War II Museum. But I did the Polar Express train ride with him the first year they did it here in New Orleans. And if you don't know what the Polar Express is, there's a book about it. There's also a movie. It's the thing with Tom Hanks. And it's like, it's a really cool, cute movie. It's very Christmassy. You probably already know what it is. But John was, he is the star of the entire show. He plays Santa, or he's well, he is Santa. What am I talking about? I'm not even saying he's playing Santa, because he is Santa. But he's that's where I met him, and I was also on that same show, and we just kind of got a chance to know each other. He also got to meet my sister as well, and just kind of understand like who we were as performers. We kind of like goofed off in the train and everything, and he was just kind of sitting there just watching us do our thing and, you know, just observing for the most part, but, you know, giving his two cents every now and then. And every time we would ask him something, like, he had a really, like, if we asked him anything, I could ask him like, so John, what do you think about the hot chocolate that we're serving? And he'll go into this very in-depth, like, like meaningful description about this hot chocolate that we were serving these kids. And I was just like, okay, yeah, John is, yeah, definitely.
John.
Yeah. But I loved it. And I was, you know, it's one thing to embody the character of Santa, but it's also like the people that portray Santa. And I feel like, and that's why I'm like, John isn't just Santa. He is Santa. What are you talking about? Because like, I feel like whether you are playing Santa or you are just being John, like, you definitely have the same characteristics that a lot of people find in who Santa Claus is to them. So,
yeah.
But also, if the listeners, if you're listening and you have, and you're not like watching us talk, he basically looks like Santa most of the time anyway. So it's, you know, it's just very difficult to, not difficult, but it just kind of makes it full circle. It's like the cherry on top of the full ice cream of who John is. Like, the cherry is him actually looking like Santa. Anyway.
He embodies the spirit of Santa.
Yes. Yeah.
Can say that because I live with him 24/7. He finds reasons to be more Santa.
Yeah.
Including getting a car, a white car with red interior.
Yes.
I love play. It.
Because that's what Santa will have.
I love it. Yes. I love it.
We'll We'll be seeing more of that soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We'll be doing some same videos. And so, yes.
He even has summer shirts that have a Santa motif.
I love it.
I'm surprised he's not wearing one of those shirts.
It's okay. He doesn't have to. Not for this. I mean, we're not talking about how.
And I said, well, he's on that. I'm Mrs. Santa.
Yeah.
This is a kind of a point to jump off a little and what you were talking about before.
Yeah.
I probably am able to pull this off in large part because of my father and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, and I'll just say that we each got some of those DNA tests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, said, okay, where are you from? And mine is like 85% Britain, Ireland, Scotland.
Okay.
You know, and the other thing are the rest of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hardly get whiter than I am. Hers was just amazing. This just rich variety of places. Yeah. Europe, indigenous and American, Puerto Rico, and Africa.
Yeah.
All over the place.
She gets to claim a lot of the world.
A lot of the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, the kit came for two people. He did it for me because he knew where it was coming from.
Yeah.
I knew the basics. And to see that chart, I just felt so much like a citizen of the world.
Yeah.
Kids are loving that because they're sharing all of that too.
Yeah.
Even more so. It's just amazing.
But my background is my dad was born in Oklahoma and my mother in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our ancestors, as far as we've been able to trace back, they are pretty much all farmers and preachers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few brewmeisters in there. Came to the United States back in the 1700s,
mm-hmm.
and settled in and just moved west.
Mm-hmm.
So Dad, though, was actually one of the first to go to college. And that's where he met my mom. It was here in Tennessee. So they met, they married, they had a baby right away. And then World War II started, and he joined up. Now, he was studying to be a minister.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gotten his divinity degree and all that. So when he joined the Army, he joined as a chaplain and decided to stay in after the war. So he was a career Army chaplain, which is kind of an unusual pursuit anyway. but I was born in Trieste, Italy. And then just traveled all over the world. And we finally ended up in, he retired at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. And mom went back to school there, got her library science degree. So learning, education is always a critical part of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up going to New York to go to a misguided tour of law school. Should not have done that. But I did, and it's probably just as well because that's where we met.
It was worth
so
it.
We lived in the same building,
yeah.
And it was inevitable we'd run into each other. So that worked out. But my you know, growing up as the dependent of a U.S. Army officer and being pretty privileged, we weren't rich, but we didn't want for anything.
Yeah.
So that was it. But there was a lot about him and my mother, who were, they were both really wonderful people. They were very good. I got my first lesson in race when I was probably 6 years old. And I really remember this. This was fascinating that I can even remember this. But we were, I was with some friends,
mm-hmm.
on our front porch.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was standing right behind the screen door watching us play. And we were doing a selection game,
mm-hmm.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Mm. Well, I was doing that, and I said that. And as soon as I said that, Dad opened the door and said, come here. We need to talk. And, of course, at six, you don't quite grasp what it is. Mm-hmm. It was just the word that I'd heard other kids use.
Yeah.
So that's...
Wait. Okay. Because I think I've heard the better version of that Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe thing. I think I know exactly what you're talking about, though. But keep going. Yeah. Now I am. Yeah. Okay, I got you.
So last time I ever used that word, too.
That's where it came from. I never even... Wow. Was that like the originator of like Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe?
I don't know. I don't know the
or was that just... Okay, now I'm curious. I'm going to have to go do my research on that.
Yeah, that would be interesting to know. But at any rate, that was my first lesson. And one of the advantages of growing up in the military, though, mm-hmm. also, is that the military was segregated. It was integrated. Mm-hmm. So when I went to school, these schools that all the military kids went to, there was a mix mm-hmm. of black and white. And I know a lot of my contemporaries here in Memphis who grew up in Memphis, they grew up in an all-white school. Yes. That's because back in the 60s, that's simply the way it was.
Yeah.
Even after segregation was abolished, the town still, and to a great extent today, remains segregated. Yeah, so that was my growing up experience, was that my parents didn't put up with any crap. And they always taught us to be kind, to be good. They had terrific senses of humor. Mm-hmm. And I think out of all of that, somehow I emerged and was able somehow to pull this Santa thing off. But my dad was always the kindest man, and everybody loved him. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess I'm just sort of carrying that forward. Mm-hmm. But I haven't said anything about what my actual, money-making occupation is. Mm-hmm. I'm a journalist. Mm-hmm. I started with a community newspaper in New York City, which is where we met. And then when we moved to Memphis, I started working at the Daily newspaper here. Mm-hmm. And I was there for 25 years as a reporter and an editor. And then they offered a buyout, and I said, yes, I'll take it. And I'm glad I did. That enabled me to then start doing freelance journalism. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
And I was able to do it because people still needed and paid for freelance reporting and feature articles and that sort of thing. Yeah. That began to decline, but since then, about 3 years ago or so, there also in town is what's called Memphis Magazine. It's one of those monthly city magazines. Mm-hmm. And also what's called the Memphis Flyer, which is an alt-weekly. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the same company. And I went to work for them. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm writing for the Memphis Magazine, feature stories, that sort of thing, business stories, and for the Memphis Flyer, which is, a little more edgy and that sort of thing. So, and then they are just very taken with the idea that I take off the entire month of December to go to New Orleans and party, party, party. No, that's not quite true. I don't think I've worked so hard in my life as when we're down there doing that.
Yeah.
But it's one of the great things. It's what performers love to do.
Yeah.
When I'm waiting between performances, I'm just bored silly, unless I'm talking to you. But when we're performing, oh my God, we're on. And it's a great thing. So that's kind of my thing. And, when we got married, then we had our children and we brought them up in the public schools here. And it's just kind of put our values in them, and they are, reflect that to us. Our daughter has gone to the protests, and we're mm-hmm. very, happy and supportive about that, of course. I think we'd probably go if we weren't so much at risk.
Right.
Because, we're older.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of ways to protest. You don't just have to protest in the streets. There are so many other ways you can still be impactful.
Many other ways.
We don't need to lose either of you right now. We need you. So don't go out to those protests right now. We need your voices as long as possible.
And what I try to do as much as I can is in my work, as a journalist.
Yeah.
Is making sure that I'll just tell you this briefly. Last September, the magazine had a crisis. Mm. Now, Memphis Magazine is one of the most liberal and fair magazines to be found anywhere. We do a lot of coverage of the entire community. We pay special attention to the African American community. I mean, because it's big, it's here.
Yeah,
we always do. You know, every year an issue devoted to Martin Luther King. We've done that ever since we started. So we've always been very comfortable in our liberal outlook. Last September, we decided to do a cover story on the local mayoral election. And there were three main candidates who were vying for mayor. One was the incumbent, was a white man. Second person was a former mayor who was African-American. And then the third person was a woman who was on the county commission, African-American, and known for being an activist. We took down a statue of General Nathan Bedford Forrest two or three years ago, and she was a big moving force behind that. So she got a lot of publicity, and so she ran. So we decided to put the three of them on the cover, and we hired somebody, a caricaturist, who we've all known and we've used for years, and he's really good, said, draw caricatures of all these three people, and then we'll put that on the cover. So he did, and we put it on there, and the problem was that only about three or four people on the magazine staff saw that cover. And if we'd had one or two more people, especially if one of them were black, they would have looked at it and they would have said, no, the caricature you did of that woman makes her look like this really, it's the worst kind of caricature. So the world exploded. And we ended up, we have a certain number of magazines that go out by mail to the subscribers, and then others we put on the newsstands. Well, we pulled all the newsstand copies. We have a woman who's our CEO, and she wrote a very eloquent apology about it, and I think everybody accepted what she said. But we also underwent some internal discussion about what happened. We've revamped how we do it. We make sure that a lot of eyes see any proposed covers that we have. And we are especially attentive to being diverse and inclusive in everything that we do. But that was a real come to Jesus moment there for a lot of us. Some of us decided we needed to go to the National Civil Rights Museum, which is here in town. It's where Dr. King was assassinated. It's an amazing place, and I recommend it to anybody. I learned so much, and I already know a lot about the civil rights movement.
Right.
But, oh boy, this was something else. And what's happening now, I think, with all the protests and the social changes and the responses of corporations and NASCAR and you know, all of that. A lot of that is coming from the realization that you can't just respond to something with your first feeling. You know, you have to think it through. You have to think, well, why? Why is the Black Lives Matter? That's a kind of a classic. When they started saying Black Lives Matter, it was almost a natural thing to say, well, what do you mean? All lives matter, right? Yeah. Well, once you think about it, once you listen to what it means, and you're, if your mind is open, then you understand perfectly well.
And if you place it in a historical time in which the human life of a black person was not recognized as such. If you put it in the context of when the value of a black person was as much as the value of a cow, of any animal.
Or like in the Constitution, said three-fifths.
When you think about it, when you consider all that in a historical context, that word, Black Lives Matters, it means so much more of what anyone, even considerate, enlightened, may want to consider.
So we when we met there in New York, I actually remember meeting her in around Thanksgiving of 1978. She does not remember that. She does not remember that.
Briefly, in passing.
I remember. She's very memorable. the following February, we got together again, and our building in New York was actually, you know, they talk about New York as being
beautiful,
so unfriendly and all that. Well, that people's beautiful. Doors were open, you know, you could smell what they were cooking, and mm-hmm. People would visit back and forth. So we got to
Best
know each other
yeah.
and started dating in no time. And we were married by November that year, 79. Yeah.
It was a friend of mine who talked to me about him because I needed some graphic work done for a catalog for an exhibition I was having in one of the galleries in Soho. And so I met him that way, but I did not give him the job because he was charging me. And by then I was dating someone else that decided, and some people in the building, they told me, we want to do that for free. But I sent him a friend of mine who actually, he did a job for him. But by the time the catalog was printed, we were starting dating, and he ended up folding that catalog.
Folding and stuffing it. So, yep.
Uh-huh. Yep. So he always remind me of that job that I filed him off, which is not true because I never hiring that I hiring him for the job in the first place. He keeps reminding me, and I ended up folding the catalog from the work you do not give me, you file me from.
Oh my gosh.
But he started dating, so that was
yeah.
okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now, and it proceeded rapidly. Kind of the first big thing, we decided pretty early that we were going to get married. February, March, April.
In March,
May,
you proposed.
Yeah, in March, I proposed. May, for the Memorial Day weekend, one of my nieces was getting married here in Memphis. And so we decided, well, let's go down for that. And we didn't really quite know it at the time, but it was just one of those events, and the timing
Everyone
of it was such
came.
That everybody in my family came. Aunts and uncles and cousins from all over mm-hmm. showed up. So, and this was her introduction to my family. This poor thing, you know, coming down to Memphis with this entire clan of people.
Yeah.
And I did very well, I might say.
You did well. I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried about you at all. I, you know, did think about, but what about all my white relatives? But none of them had ever given any indication of being rednecks. That's not true now, but
well.
But yeah, and they were accepting, I think, and it was and it was important because she got to meet my mother, who passed away shortly after that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a huge deal to, you know, within months, throwing her into this situation where she met this big clan of people that she was marrying into.
And we got married in November.
We got married in November.
No. From my side, my friends were very concerned because what they could see, it was they could see a separation in terms like, well, you're Puerto Rican and mixed. He's white and Anglo. There's a big difference in there.
Mm-hmm.
But what they forgot was that my father was a teacher and an artist, a musician, a composer, somebody who value cultural and value knowledge in a huge way.
Yeah.
So was his father.
Yeah. And you, those are the good characteristics that you found in your father
yeah.
and him. And you, like.
He was learning music. He did music, you know, and he trained for a while in a classical instrument.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a musician trained in classic music also. He loves literature. I love literature. My father loved literature.
I found that as we were in this process of dating and getting to know each other, I almost didn't realize it at first, but it's like you have a little checklist in your head.
Uh-huh.
You know, oh, she wants children. I want children. Oh, okay. Oh, her father's an artist. That's cool. Oh, yeah. It's like my father. And mm-hmm. pretty soon all these little things began to click
mm-hmm.
that we had in common.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon it was clear what we had to do.
Yeah, people saw nationality and race. I saw a person from which I had so many interests in common.
Yeah.
We love movies. We love theater. I did theater when I was in high school. He did theater when he was in high school.
That theater connection is like no other.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
You can't touch that.
To my craft of being an artist, he was dedicated to his craft of being a writer.
Yeah.
So we're both artists.
Yeah.
And so we enjoy an intelligent conversation.
Yeah.
Politics of whatever thing there is, even if we do not agree, we do enjoy an intelligent conversation.
That's really all that matters. If you can agree to disagree, but the love is still there.
Yeah. When you meet somebody that you feel, I'd rather be with this person.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the main thing.
I feel so comfortable with this person. I'd rather be with this person than spending more time than any other person I know.
Yeah.
When that person become your biggest supporter, when we became our biggest supporters of each other's efforts.
May I ask y'all, since we're on the subject of how y'all got to meet and how y'all started loving each other, do y'all remember the specific individual moments that y'all were like, okay, this is going to be the person I'm going to be with for the rest of my life?
Oh my God. He knew before I did.
Okay.
I don't know that I remember a specific moment, but it was just that it was happening pretty quickly. I mean,
very quickly.
You know, you go out on the first date, go to a restaurant. Okay, that's nice. And then, you know, you get to know each other a little bit. But then it just picked up steam.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she tried to break it off once, but.
Yeah, it was so fast
mm-hmm.
that I told him, we need some time. I need some time. This is coming along.
It's scary.
I get scared. He was a little bit disappointed that I got scared.
So and I just said, okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Well, he didn't say that. He showed up the next day. And I said, but didn't I tell you that I needed some time? I said, well, yeah, but, you know. You
gotta eat. Let's go eat. Yeah.
I realized it when I have a talk to my cousin. You know, he's a dear person to me. I don't see enough of him. I haven't seen him in decades. I haven't seen him for over 40 years. As long as we've been together, I have not seen him. But I know where he is, and we were really close. Because from all the people, when I was growing up, a little nerdy and a little into myself, a little much in books, a little into classic music, a little bit into theater. When everybody was making fun of me because I was too much of that,
mm-hmm.
he was offending me. He said, oh, she dressed like a fashionista. When that word was not used. Oh, she is special. And so I always had that affinity. And I told him, I met this guy. He's a white guy, you know. But look at this and this and this and this and this. And he told me, you know what? It seems to me that you really like that person, that you're already in love with that person. And I just said, oh my God, yeah, you're right. And I finished it all. And with that being assured from his part, I said, hey, you know, if I let this guy go, I am the stupid one. So then My father was very happy because I was the oldest. My two of the sisters were married and I was not. Everybody has stopped asking me. I have met someone for a while now because they just give up on me. And
you were pretty old too.
I was 27.
Yeah. I guess that's pretty old in that time.
He was 30, I was 27 when we got married. We were on our own. So that certainty that we have done whatever we felt we needed to do.
Yeah. Y'all had already had your individual independence. Is that what you're saying? Like you were able to kind of, you know, figure yourself out before y'all like really met and like got a chance to know each other.
I finished my MFA degree, which is a terminal degree for fine arts. And I was working and I have my own apartment.
Yeah.
He was working. He has his own apartment, had done whatever he wanted to do, you know. So we felt that that was done. That's part of our life was done. Next one, which came to surprise for me because things happen when you're not expecting them.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking for anyone. He wasn't looking for anyone. We just found each other. I was dating somebody else.
Yeah.
So we found each other and it was like a, this like a, whoa. But it, one of the things that really scared me was that on our first date, he held my hand. And he said that he would change some things for me. And I said, what in the world is this guy talking about? I don't want that responsibility of anyone having to change anything for me.
Right.
I just want it.
You're used to being independent. You want to be able to change it for yourself.
No. I don't want anyone, you know, I didn't want anyone like that. I just want a person who is secure of himself, who's he was, ended up that he was, and secure about myself. And so when my friends get worried or concerned, I just took it like, you just don't know this person. My mother was a caretaker. She was a housewife, but also when she started working, she was taking care of elderly people.
Yeah.
And they adore her. My mother was the most natural person, natural person you may want to know. She came from people who worked the land, similar to his background. Mm-hmm. See, my father was a teacher. I appreciated education, his too. My mother took care of people and it came from the land. All my family from the side, from my mother's side, were coffee growers. They grew up in the mountains. That's where she came from. So this city guy, my father, a black dude, too cool, because he was a musician and he was an artist and he was playing in radio and TV, starting courting this white lady, very young lady, because my father was almost 20 years older than her. It was his fifth marriage. We were the fifth family he had.
My goodness. You know?
And this young lady decided to marry this man of a complete different race.
Yeah.
Against her family, you know, against all odds. And made this marriage, they both died within a month of each other.
Oh my goodness. It's
and they have all of us. And my father was my biggest supporter, and so was my mother on her own way. My father took me to the university. I was the first graduate from college and the only one so far in my family with a terminal degree. I think now I have a niece who also have a master's, you know. But I came from a trailblazer type of family.
That's exactly what I was saying in my head as you were telling me. So I was like, man, pioneers, yeah. Like.
My father adored theater and adored concerts. and adored movies, and I was the one he took with. Mm-hmm. He said, "Bless Samaritza, we're going to a concert." Or he would come and pick me up at the theater, and the people will say, "You are the daughter of Moncho Davila, this famous musician? I didn't know you were. She was your daughter." You know, so I grew up surrounded with people who knew my father, and they stopped us at every corner to talk to him. And I was at awe of all of these people who knew my father. I was going to the TV to watch him play the guitar. I was going to the radio. I listened to my father on the radio. I watched him on TV. I knew all the international touring and all the important people he knew, you know. So, you know, and my mother was the biggest supporter and the caretaker. And it was so much love.
Yeah.
Because she was so special. So I'm such an amazing, talented cook.
She passed that on to him, by the way.
So that's where I come from, for these two human beings, talented on his own right. And when he force and dramas and chaos and lovelessness and all of the stuff. So looking back during this conversation, we had such an upbringing together. I mean, we came from a very well-established family.
Yeah, you were loved and you had family.
We worked that together, yes. So that was our example.
Yeah.
And so when I decided to get married, I didn't decide to marry somebody like my father. I decided to get married because I was old enough to this person to whom I could share so much with.
Yeah.
And that's so much fun to be with.
Yeah.
We do have fun together.
We do.
I can tell y'all have fun together.
It's even cooking, we have fun together. He's becoming my sous chef in the kitchen.
Okay.
He doesn't cook, but he dies so good, so well. He knows how to dice.
And I know how to work that dishwasher.
Hey.
Yeah, and he knows that if I cook, he takes
care. He cleans. He gets to use the dishwasher very well.
And we have been willing to grow with each other regardless of our differences.
Yeah.
We have been willing to grow with each other, and we have gone high and lows in our mm-hmm. lives together. And yeah. we have managed always to go to end up on the other side and appreciate each other even more so because of the experience.
It makes it so unique and rich and, gosh, I'm like just hearing your story. It's been so inspiring. I'm like as you're saying these things, like I'm like reflecting on my own life and I'm like, wow, like similarities and differences, but like mostly similarities. And I was like, it's almost like you trusted your gut after a bit to continue the relationship that y'all now have now. But it was mostly from your understanding each other's humanity first and foremost. Yeah. And understanding where each person came from. That transcends racial, you know, appearances or anything. Like looking at the core values that your parents have instilled in both of you, y'all were able to see that and recognize, oh my gosh, like great foundations in both places. Let's put this together and make an even bigger foundation, you know, like.
Yeah. Even now, being so stressed with what I'm doing and what he's trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
There's no day that I not say, how did I get so lucky? Or sometimes I tell him, how do we get this lucky? To find each other.
Yeah.
When you see so many other people not making it.
Ugh.
After we get married, we have like a roller coaster of friends getting married.
Oh. Apparently we inspired
y'all inspired to... other people to get married, but those people didn't have to do the work that y'all did to get to where you are.
No, I think that maybe one of the couples, and we went to so many weddings before we got married.
Yeah.
You know, it was my friend's wedding, his friend's wedding. Well, you know,
Yeah.
And I was.
Oh, you know what? We haven't yet told her the story about our wedding.
Oh, come on. Yes, tell me about it. Tell me about it.
Not one, not two, but three weddings. Yes.
Okay. Tell me about it.
We did the whirlwind thing. We said, all right, we're going to get married. And so we have all our friends here in New York. We want them to be at the wedding. All of my family is in Memphis. We want them to be at the wedding. But all of her family is in San Juan, Puerto Rico. How are we going to do this? There's no way we get them all in one place.
No.
Yeah.
So we said, first in November, we'll get married at City Hall in New York.
But one thing that would take care of the legal aspect.
So that was done. That was done. And we had some friends with us when we did that, just went to City Hall.
It was so much fun. It was a weekend of Thanksgiving. And then we took the train to Boston because that's our favorite place to go.
Yeah. So then to take care of everybody else, he said, now we will schedule a wedding ceremony in Memphis 1 month after the one in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then a week after that, we'll go to San Juan and get married there.
Because what happened was that when I called my family and told them, we just got married. My family said, oh, and we didn't see you getting married.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, if you want to, you can go ahead and get married again.
This was one of the advantages, was that each family could do it the way they wanted to.
Yeah. So I love it, though.
We came to Memphis. My father is a minister, so he did the ceremony.
Yeah.
And it at a local church here. And then we went back to the house. And I have a nephew who is a chef, and he made a unique cake. I mean, there was a swan. There was a swan swimming in a
raspberry lake.
Raspberry.
Wow.
Raspberry lake.
This is a little strange. Raspberry.
It was so good. Our family got to do all of that. And then we hopped on a plane. It took my dad, actually, and he was... When we went to San Juan, he was my best man there. And we got married in the Catholic church.
His mother asking, you should go. He says, you should meet the family. She was already in poor health.
Yeah.
His mother told him, you should go.
Yeah.
And meet the rest of the family.
So Dad did. So, you know, we went to San Juan and then had our third wedding ceremony there. So we had a civil servant, a Protestant minister, and a Catholic priest.
Uh-huh.
We've often wondered if we should have gotten a rabbi in there somewhere.
I don't know.
But maybe still. You never know.
Hey.
Maybe a little, whatever little bit of Jewish I have on me, perhaps.
She's got more Jewish in her than I do in me.
It's so negligible. The indigenous part is more.
So I have another question. I have all these questions. Thankfully, y'all have answered a lot of the questions that people have been asking just from your talking. I love the way that y'all discuss. Like, I don't even want to like get into it because I'm just like, y'all just conversate so well. Converse, whatever. I use this. It's the same meaning. I just say different things. Anyway, I wanted to know, because I also thought this was a very interesting question, and I'm going to ask both of you this question, but were there any biases that you had to unlearn about each other that you realized were problematic about each other during any of this? Like, was there anything that, I mean, it can come from both ways. Like, it just be problematic in the sense that it's just problematic from, like, your perspective, whether it actually is problematic as a systemic, you know.
I have something, but it has nothing to do with prejudice, but maybe more culturally than anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true that when I have problems, but I've seen that also being said about men and women.
Yeah.
But being a Latina, I don't hold back. I just speak up my mind, and sometimes very emotionally. He has a tendency of doing the reverse. He have a hard time sometimes doing confrontations. And he had learned to speak up his mind more.
Mm-hmm.
And I have learned to be a little bit more, to think it before talking. And maybe to tame a little bit my emotional Latina side. I'm not always successful on it. That stressed him and ended up stressing me because I think how stressed he is. And I'm really bad at holding emotions.
Okay. So what you're basically saying is that there's a cultural difference in the way that you guys express each other's, like, you know.
I don't even know if that's what it is.
I'm not sure we ever even really thought of it so much as being cultural. Because yes, there are the tropes about the reserved Englishman and the fiery Latina.
Yeah.
You look through relationships anywhere, anytime. Very often, it's just that opposites do attract.
Uh-huh.
So one partner is a little more reserved. The other one is very outgoing.
And I'm so happy that it's that way. Because this man can say to me, okay, you're feeling that way? Go ahead and climb the wall. And when you are finishing climbing the wall, you can come down and then we can talk. And I can count that he will allow me to do that.
Yeah.
And that most of the time he will be okay with it. And it can be all fired up and he allows me to be that way because at times also he realized you're right. So opposites do attract. I think opposites are necessary. I could not live with anyone like me. Would drive me bonkers. I don't want anyone like me. I want somebody like him.
Well, like with any relationship, it's finding that balance.
Absolutely.
I can't really think of anything that I felt that I needed to change my way of thinking about, partly because I don't let myself get into a way of thinking without there being a good reason. So I have principles, for example, and I wouldn't change those for anybody. If I think our relationship was more about discovering things about the other and then saying, more. Music is one. Now she has this whole, library of tunes from Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and Cuban, all the Latin music that I had, just a little bit of experience with. But she had this huge library. And so I got to appreciate that and learn about that. So it's things like that where you tend more to expand where you need to expand rather than pull back, because we try not to carry any prejudices. If you do, I mean, for me, it's always been some sort of prejudice. I think about things first, which is why in some discussions I won't say anything. I want to wait and see, what's going on with this. That I think is actually partly a journalist tool. When I interview somebody, I have my little intro telling them this is what I'm doing. This is the story I want to write and all that. And then kind of give them a lead off question and let them carry it from there.
Mm-hmm.
And very often people will be talking about themselves. So that's not hard to, they will gladly do that. So that's kind of how it's been for me. When I walk into a room, if I'm covering an event of some sort, I just stay in the background, stay in the shadows, watch how the room is. Yeah. Reading the room is what you do. And then you see where the interest is, the power, where interesting things are happening. And so similarly in a relationship, if you don't really know something, or if you have carried some sort of belief for a while, or presumption really would be more like it, not necessarily prejudice, but I just always assumed that Latin women were fill in the blank, then you go and then you get to know them a little better and you find out, okay, yeah, I'm gonna put that one aside.
I think from the beginning, there was such an admiration and respect, mutual admiration and respect, because we allow for each one of us a space to do what they need to do. At yeah. times, I needed him and he's not available, and I go, but I said, okay, I had to wait for him. I had to wait his time. And I ended up solving it myself. And then I called and I said, okay, I decided to do this. And he said, well, okay, I think that that works. I said, okay, confirmation. But my space and his space is sacred to each one of us. So we work very hard to give that a space. So there might be times in which we only see each other for lunch or dinner, mm-hmm. isn't it? Because even working in the house, the two of us, I'm in my studio, he's in his office working, and that is the time that we meet. When John goes into my studio and said, do you have any thoughts about dinner? And I say, okay, give me a minute. I'm in the middle of something, and I'll be there. Or I tell him, why don't you start this and this and this? Or I tell him, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, what about if I make burgers? I say, fantastic. I'm too busy here today. And it's always been that way. When the kids were small and I get into my studio and they needed me, John will take care of that. He said, leave your mom alone. She's working in the studio. I never felt like I could not do something because I didn't have somebody to help me. I have gone to studios, workshops, and stuff like that to work since Joshua was maybe 4 years old. Mm-hmm. I would go, he took care of him. For whatever time, I have to go and work.
So I've actually got another meeting in about 10 minutes or so.
Oh, yeah.
You had some more questions?
Actually, no, I had one more. And like y'all literally answered all of them. And this is actually a good one to just kind of wrap everything up. So the topics that we all discussed, we basically discussed about everything that's going on that happened in your past. Is there anything you maybe wish that you had discussed 40 years ago that you didn't? That now is resurfacing now because of everything going on that, you know, you were like, oh man, we could have talked about this 40 years ago. Has there been anything?
No.
I can't think of anything that's like momentous. I mean, people who really have it together, you know, at the beginning of their relationship, they will do all the sort of unpleasant things like make a will and do all of that planning. We still have not done that. Now, I have a list, of things that we need to do, and that's been on the list for about 40 years.
And we talk it up. Once in a while, it comes in conversations. So, oh, yeah, that's the thing that we need to do.
Right.
Okay. But in this day and age, you know, with all this going on, where, that would be something that is really more of a priority.
Yeah.
We knew what we were exposing ourselves when we got married. We went into this marriage with eyes wide open.
Y'all were very open from the get-go, so you have nothing at this point.
I told John, you sent pictures of me to your family. Mm-hmm. And I took pictures of him to my family.
We've been also fortunate in that I got into journalism there back in the late 70s when it existed. And I was able to move from New York and get a job at the newspaper here in Memphis and work there for 25 years. And then another 10, 15 years now since then doing the same thing. I feel very fortunate now to be working in print media full time. Yeah. And that's certainly a lot more rare now than it was then. But we've always been kind of fortunate that way. Mm-hmm. Maritza had good timing. The year that we moved to Memphis, she went to the Memphis College of Art and
to take
and audited a couple of courses.
Yeah.
And then the next season or next
semester,
the printmaking instructor quit. Here
Hello.
You have a, print, like a master's degree.
I was there. I knew about the place.
Mm-hmm.
For me at that point, Memphis was a big interrogation mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I have lots of apprehensions because of what you heard about the South.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up that being married to him and looking the way I look allowed people to know me before assuming things about who I was.
Yeah.
Teaching at the college, which is a very open community of artists, allowed me to do and to grow as a teacher, which is my other passion.
So she was at the College of Art for 36 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that turned out okay.
Yeah. Sure did.
Yeah. And now I'm part-timing at the University of Memphis because the professor worked out. He took an early, he decided to retire. And since I've been in this town for so long, people know me and know my work, and they know about my integrity as an artist and as a professional and as a teacher. They called me and said, we need you. So I am teaching one course. Next semester will be two courses. I don't know how long I want to do it, but I have my studio and I'm being very busy with one thing and the other since my retirement, including traveling.
We've been fortunate.
Yeah.
It looks like you're living exactly how you have wanted to live for yourself. And that is all that really matters in the end. Like that is goals for me, you know, like thinking about like, you know, where I will be hopefully in the next couple of decades. I'm hoping the same thing, you know, so.
Yeah. The best is icing on the cake.
Yes.
Plus I'm Santa.
And yeah, that too. She's also married to Santa Claus, so she can get anything she wants.
And we're also collaborators. I mean, we have collaborated. As a matter of fact, we just got an award and we are collaborating on a project for the Urban Arts Commission.
Some poetry I've written and photos I took and a book that she's going to make and a film that we're going to do.
And images of both our works.
I love it.
So we have been collaborating on and off for a few years now.
Yeah.
Some places to raise funds, like the Child Advocacy Center. We have worked together on that. And we are learning every day. We are learning how to collaborate with less stress.
Yeah.
That's an ongoing process.
Keeps us sane.
Keeping you sane.
Yes.
And never take each other for granted. Never.
Y'all are absolutely amazing, inspiring. I cannot wait for everyone to listen to just hearing your story and everything that you've just brought to this community. I don't know if y'all realize how much you just brought. Like, it's still for me, like, I'm glad that I'm recording this and I get to go back and listen to all this. And I'm just going to be shaking my head like, I cannot believe I have been blessed to meet both of you and to know both of you. Thank you so much.
We are very fortunate to know you. And again, I admire so much what you're doing. So
thank you
for having us. It's an honor.
Thank you. As I've said before, like, when it comes to self-awareness, you have to have self-reflection. These two have done that before they even met. So they were able, like the conversation, just the dynamic that they are embodying. And like, I am like literally feeling through the screen right now is very, it's exactly as an embodiment of how I'm hoping that I can be. I mean, I know I probably am at this point, but like, you know, at that, you know, like I'm hoping I can stick with it. I don't want anything in my life to come in my way that I lose what I already have. And they are a great example. They are the perfect example, I should say, that I can definitely look up to. I'm so thankful to know y'all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
These two, y'all, I really enjoyed my conversation with them. It was so humbling. I was smiling the entire time. My face is sore from how much I smiled listening to them talk. Their vibe and their dynamic is goals, like real relationship goals. And I hope that anyone that is listening to them is inspired by them just as much as I was. And as I've said in the podcast, I will be posting this on YouTube too. So make sure you check it out so you can see their lovely faces and you can see John's get up as Santa or as John, however you like to look at it. If you're all caught up on all the episodes that I've posted so far, feel free to log on to Self-Aware Millennials Patreon, where I will be adding more bonus episodes so you can get your whole Self-Aware Millennial fix. But other than that, y'all, thank y'all so much for listening to another episode of the Self-Aware Millennial. I will talk to y'all later. Have a great week. Bye.